Welcome to Think Big with Dan and Qasim. Join host Dan Melnick and Qasim Masood as they explore big ideas, limitless possibilities, and engage with visionaries, entrepreneurs, and thought leaders who dare to dream big. Get inspired, motivated, and find practical tips for personal growth. Think big, dream bigger, and ignite your potential.
All right, welcome to Think Big with Dan and Qasim, and our guest today is Austin. So Austin, if you want to go ahead and introduce yourself, tell us where you live and what you do for a living.
Yeah, hey, I'm Austin Allred, the co-founder and CEO of the Bloom Institute of Technology, also known as Bloom Tech. We used to be called Lambda School, so some folks have heard of us by that name. But yeah, at a high level, we train people to be software engineers, data scientists in live online classes. We use a lot of AI to do so. And we try to keep everything that we do as close to, and you only pay once you're hired or after you get a job, as we can. So depending on where you're located, and there are a bunch of, you know, different versions of that, but that's the high level of it.
Awesome. So where are you guys located, and where are the people located typically that you usually serve?
Yeah, so we, before COVID, we had an office in San Francisco and an office in Lehigh for the staff. But the students have always been fully remote. We've never had a physical classroom, so to speak. We are mostly in every state in the U.S., I guess with the exception of New Mexico right now. They have a law that doesn't allow anybody who's not a Title IV registered entity to teach. So we're not in New Mexico. And couple weeks ago, we opened up internationally. We haven't made a big deal about that, and we haven't told very many people, but as long as you're in a country that is legal to do business with the United States, we've got folks in Qatar and Mexico and Canada and India and all over the place now. So it's a lot of fun.
Awesome. So how did you even get the idea to start this business in the first place?
Yeah, it kind of grew organically out of just what I was doing. So the short version of the story is, I was in college. I was super bored. I wasn't getting out of it what I wanted to get out of it. I knew I wanted to be in tech somehow. So I didn't have very much money. I was in college at the time. So I drove out to Silicon Valley. I had a Honda Civic. So I just, laid the back seat down and the passenger seat down. And I lived in that Honda Civic while I taught myself enough code to be dangerous, so to speak. And ended up, working a solid job, making six figures in Silicon Valley, and had moved there from small town Utah. So when I'd go back to small town Utah, everyone would say, "Oh my gosh, like how, the median income in the town that I moved from is like $30,000 a year." So everyone's like, six figures at the time was insane, especially to, folks in central Utah. And so people would say, "I want to do what you did." And I was like, not really. You don't really want to do what I did. That was that's not the play if you're a father or a mother of four kids, not making much. So originally we just said, there are a handful of code schools out there. Let's make a code school that's really, really good, that teaches you the computer science stuff that, the boot camps out there don't teach. And then if we do it entirely online, which seems obvious now, but at the time it was kind of crazy, if you would have, we were Slack and Zoom were kind of new, to give you an idea of like what era of tech that was. And so we had to introduce most of our students to Zoom, like, "Hey, download this thing and it works pretty well." And people would say, "Hey, I don't have a great connection." And, Zoom kind of enabled a lot of what we did. But yeah, we started teaching people and we would charge, some amount upfront. I think it was $10,000 for full time or something like that. And pretty quickly we found that everybody we talked to said, "Hey, that's really cool, but I don't have $10,000. And if I end up with $10,000 of debt that I can't pay back, like that's life altering for me." So we said, "Oh," and there was one student that I was talking to and I was like, consider me paying your tuition. Like if you'll pay a little bit of deposit up front, then you can just pay me the rest after you're hired. How would that sound?" He was like, "That sounds like the best thing that has ever happened to me." And so I started talking to other people like, "Would that be interesting?" And it was a resounding, "Yes, that's exactly what we need." And at the time we were young enough that I was like, Oh, this is pretty obvious. Like, you need to go to other code schools and say, hey, just like do it for free until you're hired. And they were all like, no, that breaks the entire economic model. It's 10 times harder. People aren't committed. Like, it's an entirely different business. And I was like, you know what? They're probably right. It is, but it's a business that needs to exist. So we started there, and it grew insanely quickly over the next few years.
All right. So, what are the main tech stacks you are teaching your students right now?
Yeah, so we have a full stack web program. Obviously, that's primarily JavaScript. We've gone back and forth between, how much Python we want to layer in, how much we used to do a lot of C. We like getting people as close to the metal as you can. What we found is that it's a trade-off. So now we have most of our other languages as more supplemental stuff for people who want to get into it. For a lot of people, it makes more sense just to get really, really, really good at JavaScript instead of, really good at JavaScript and then touching C for the first time. And like, it's a good exercise to see like, oh, what's a pointer? How does memory management work? But it makes more sense most of the time to do most of that in JavaScript. So that's for our full stack program. Now we have a backend program that we kind of co-built with Amazon. And so that is for, people that want to work at a very, very big company. Generally, those are very highly paid roles. And that's Java based. Obviously, if Java, you can move over to C Sharp, and it's not a big deal. And that one touches JavaScript, but not really. It's mostly like hardcore backend, data heavy, cloud heavy Java. And then our data science program similarly touches JavaScript a little bit, but it's large, and you can play with R in it a little bit, but it's primarily Python. So we consider ourselves, I love Lisp-like languages. I love Haskell. I love Lisp itself, but the market is much more for JavaScript, especially the junior level. So we stick to what the market demands.
So it means you are covering from beginners to experts. You are giving training to the beginners and you are giving training to the experts as well, probably. So
Yeah,
what's your
so the full stack program takes you from zero. Like, if you can turn a computer on, it's like here's what's an IDE, here's an editor, here's a file, like that level. And the way we've built it is it kind of if you want to just test out all that stuff, you're like, look, I've been doing programming tutorials for years, and skip that part. The backend program assumes that you're somewhat proficient at writing Java to start, and it's actually a longer program too. So that program has higher starting salaries for a while. I mean, I think it's still true. I'd have to double check that more of the back end grads work at FAANG companies than don't. So that's a very if you want to go make a lot of money at a big company, that's an excellent way to do it. If you're like, yeah, I might want to work in a startup. I don't know if I want to do front end or back end. I want to be super flexible, and we'll see where this career takes me. Then the full stack program is more for you. And then, data science, there are elements of, data analysis and writing SQL and all that stuff. Now it's very heavily AI focused. So how do LLMs work? How does deep learning work? How do you pipe the data to the right ways? How do you build a model? How do you tweak those models? All of that stuff. So yeah.
Okay, so in AI, what are you covering at this time? You are covering, okay, you're saying like you are working on LLMs as well, and in terms of like the main categories, are you working on regenerative AI and data engineering?
Yeah, the AI is such a tricky, thing. A, because the language that we use to describe AI changes about every year. Like, it used to be, deep learning became generative AI, and and then before that it was machine learning, and before that, and before that it was AI. So it kind of went full circle, in the way you describe it. But what we really teach students is how to build models, how to train models, how to make models efficient. And we go a little bit deeper into generative AI right now for obvious reasons. But we try to like we try to teach you the principles of how AI actually works. You know, like even what is a transformer? What does, you know, what's hallucination? How do you avoid hallucination? Stuff like that. And then you know, you find that when you at 99% of AI companies, they're the people who are creating new algorithms that have never been touched before. They're research scientists that have been in the weeds for 40 or 50 years. The vast majority of people are on the other side of that. And like, okay, here's all these really cool, this is cool stuff, all these very academic research like AI people created. How do we use those in a business sense? How do we derive value from them? So, you know, we talk about how ChatGPT works, but our students aren't necessarily going to be, you know, building the next GPT tomorrow at OpenAI, right? It's a little bit different of a level. So, yeah.
Makes sense. Completely makes sense. And how you are getting your students, like what's the way of advertisement and marketing? How you're getting these students?
Yeah, our best driver by far is referrals. So, you know, we have thousands of grads now, and you can actually see sometimes, especially because we were kind of the first and now one of the only like programs where you don't have to pay any money up front. And if you don't get hired, you know, there are ways not to pay. We have a lot of students from kind of lower income backgrounds, from places where, you know, we talk to students all the time who are telling their family and friends they're going to, you know, work in software or become a computer programmer, and nobody knows what that means. So when you see someone in an environment, and I was in that environment, right? If I would have told someone I was a programmer, they would have assumed I was like fixing printers and like setting up Microsoft Word. You know, it's not a world even today that a lot of people live in. So when you see somebody like that, you know, get their first job and they start, you know, especially if they're not a college grad and they, you know, they all the time, you know, we see someone who's doubled or tripled their income. You see their family apply, you see their neighborhood apply, you see their whole church apply, like word gets out pretty quickly. Outside of that, you know, we teach a lot of free classes, and then we, you know, do have traditional, you know, we advertise on Facebook and Instagram, and I don't think we do TikTok right now, but we have in the past. So there's, you know, traditional channels, but by far our best referrers of students are students themselves.
So how do you kind of make sure that there's no churn? Because you're saying that people aren't paying until they get the job. So like, let's just say that like, I signed up and I quit halfway through. Like, what does that look like?
Yeah, so it depends on, we try to make as much of the churn happen as quickly as we can. Because you are going to get people who are shopping, who aren't serious, who are you know, not sure if tech is for them. And then even if they are sure it's for them, aren't willing to put in the work. I mean, there are people who, you know, assume that if you show up to a software engineering school, you magically become a software engineer. So the good news is everything that all of our weeding out is work-based. And it's like, you know, we've tried a million things over the 4 or 5 years to try to determine, you know, who is the right, you know, speaking frankly, who is smart enough and who is working hard enough and like who crosses both of those bars. And you know, to be frank, there are people who like it just cognitively cannot do it, or at a minimum cannot like handle the level of rigor that we teach. Like I like to say, I can't tell anybody that they can't become a programmer, but I can tell you that we're not the path to get you there for one reason or another, right? And so what we do now is just give everybody a free trial. So anybody anywhere in the world can, you know, sign up for Bloom Tech, get into the introductory material. It's still live, interactive. You have a career coach the same way you do in the rest of the program. It's obviously, there's slightly different ratios. We don't have as much one-on-one attention as you would, you know, the full program. But we try to teach you how to program. And if you can figure out the basics of how to learn to program, turns out you're going to be able to learn to program. If you are unable to do that, it's difficult from our end to, you know, we've had tests in the past that, you know, measure cognitive ability and, you know, learning style and all this stuff. And those are actually fairly predictive, but it's far simpler and more meaningful and less painful to just have everybody try to learn to program and see if you like it. And then even once you're in the program, there's a period where, you know, if you drop out, there's no payment whatsoever. We can't do that all the way until the day before graduation, or we would have 100% of people going until the day before graduation. So there's, you know, a fee cycle that starts to kick in and is graduate, similar to like founder vesting kind of thing. So it starts small and it builds up over time. So, we're trying to be as fair as we can. And that's basically how it works.
So in terms of like now you mentioned that you're scaling internationally. So obviously the salary of somebody in India is different from somebody here in the States. So what does that look like in terms of like how they're going to pay for the course if they're located in a country where the salaries are, you know, way less than here?
Yeah. So I think we found, we looked at a bunch of different financial models and tried a bunch of different things. And I'm sure it will evolve over time. But what we like to do a lot is set a minimum income threshold, and that's different in every country, right? So if you're in the US and you get a job as a software engineer making $40,000 a year, you still don't have to pay us anything. Now, granted, there aren't very many of those, right? Software engineer, generally speaking, should be. So our minimum income threshold in the US is 50. And I wish that we could, I wish there were an easy way to have it more demographically aligned, because, you know, 50 still isn't great in San Francisco. It's crushing it in parts of Ohio. So, you know, there's big disparities in income. Internationally, there's two things. There's kind of your local market, and then there's an international remote market, which is somewhat, it's still getting formulated, but there are kind of norms and means that are getting figured out there. So internationally, it varies a little bit country to country, but generally speaking, our minimum income threshold is 20,000 US. And then your payments, so we used to do, your payment would vary based on what your income was. But that just gets extremely difficult to calculate from, you know, currencies and different, are benefits layered into what you're paid as a contractor, or are they separate? What if you get a hiring bonus? How does equity play into all of that? So now internationally, I think we say it's $200. It's between $200 and $250 a month for 5 years. So it ends up being, depending on when you enroll, $12,000 to $15,000 total. But, you know, we make it so that if you increase your income by $3,000 a year, it pays for itself. And then everything else on top of that, obviously, you keep. So that was a very long-winded way to say it's, you know, $200 to $250 bucks a month for 5 years. And if you want to pay it off faster, you're welcome to. There's no interest. It doesn't grow, which is probably not smart on our end, but we think it's affordable for pretty every software engineer, data scientist on the planet. So
makes sense. So what is the eligibility criteria to enroll someone in a course?
Yeah, that's one thing that we're pretty militant about. In the US, there are eligibility criteria around can you work legally? We do see a decent amount of, you know, I'd love to learn to be a software engineer and then get a job, but I don't have a work visa. We can't do very much to fix that, you know. So for the most part, as long as you are legally eligible to work in the country that you live in, and you are able to learn to program or, you know, manipulate data and willing to work hard, that's all we require. There are, I should specify, in different states in the US, there are what are called eligibility to benefit tests. So we have to make sure that you either have graduated high school or have a GED, or, you know, but some of our best students ever have a GED, never stepped foot in a college, and absolutely crush it. So we don't want to eliminate those folks. I do want to, like, that does not mean that it's for everybody, right? It is really hard. It is strenuous. It is difficult. A lot of our students will say it's the most difficult thing they've ever done. There's a little bit of that that's by design, but it's mostly just going from, you know, zero to hireable software engineer in less than a year. It's just a hard thing to do. The good news is if you do it, it changes the rest of your life forever. But we're not in the camp of either, hey, this is super easy, or we think that everybody should do this and become a software engineer. It's definitely not for everybody.
All right, obviously. So how many instructors do you have, and how do you recruit the instructors?
It varies based on the number of students we have. Think that, and I don't even know the number. So we have different levels of support. We have instructors, we have curriculum developers, we have what we call learning assistants, which are similar to TAs. We have tier one support, which is kind of a level, like I need immediate support, and there are different types of the organization that can't handle that. I would say overall, we have 50 or 60 right now. That's not including curriculum developers or instructional design and stuff like that. That's just, you know, people who are on the ground helping people. And that scales up or down depending. We built some pretty elegant software to do this, depending on how many students there are in each unit, even at any given time. So we try to, our program is very flexible and also very programmatic. So we try to make it so that wherever you are, whatever time zone you're in, there's an instructor there to help you at that given time. And we try to keep people together for as much of the program as we can. But it's not the traditional classroom where, you know, you show up every day and there's one person for 9 months. You'll see different instructors. You won't really see very much of different teaching style. We found that it's much more effective if we're very prescriptive on, you know, you say this with some variation here, and then you say that with some variation there, and then you take in the student's input here, and based on the input, you can go this way or that way, just to eliminate the variability. Then as far as how do we find instructors, we've done, over the years, we've tried a little bit of everything, you know, from, hey, let's only hire people at Google and Stanford. That was probably the worst results that we ever had. Turns out that people who are really good software engineers do not always make really good teachers. And vice versa is not true either. People who are really good teachers do not necessarily make really good software engineering teachers. So we go through a lot of applicants. We have a testing methodology to test both of those things, have people teach sample lessons. And then we hire, usually starting on a contract, and then, you know, get to know somebody and expose them to more students, and then can go full-time later. So it's a pretty, that filtering process is really important for us.
Makes sense. In fact, I was curious about how you're finding instructors in the whole world, because you are serving in the whole world in different time zones. So it is really difficult to manage these instructors plus students.
That's a whole... There's a whole team, but that's all they do is find and manage instructors. And, you know, that's a whole line of work. It's not as simple as, you know, here's the instructor manager and they manage. Like, no, it's a whole, it's a constant recruiting. And I mean, you get to a point where, okay, it took a while, but we found really, really good people, and we have a, you know, surplus of really, really good people, but getting there is tough. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, in terms of right now, what would you say is like your top priority, you know, going into this year and even next year, or like on the end of this year, I should say?
Yeah, I think, you know, we are, we have like different teams with very different sets of metrics. We divide them into pods. So each pod will have a number of goals, and we're really just trying to ramp up each of those goals at any given time. So we have an admissions and enrollment team, and that encompasses, we call it the grow pod. So that encompasses, you know, marketing and enrollment coaches, which are the people that talk to people who are coming in. They have an enrollment target and then an activity rate target. So, you know, we need to get this many people in the door this month. And of those, we need to make sure that, you know, this many people of those are actually going to stick it out, because like I said, we don't get paid. If we enroll a million people and then nobody, you know, progresses in the course, it does nothing for us. And then we have what we call the learn pod, and that is divided into separate groups. There's a pacing group, and their job is making sure the students are moving through the course, because it is, we use mastery-based progression. So you don't move on from one topic until you've mastered that topic. So their job is making sure that people are staying on pace, identifying people that are falling behind, you know, identifying any weak spots or confusing points in the course. But really, they mostly serve as like accountability for the students. Like, hey, are you, you know, it looks like you're weak on, I don't know, for loops. Let's, you know, when are you going to spend time on for loops outside of class this week? Let's put it on the schedule. Let's get you with a learning assistant, you know. Then we, so that's the pacing group. We have, and there's a retention subgroup within them that is just, you know, make sure that people understand the net, make sure that people are, you know, keep going. And then our biggest group is a qualified placement group, and that's making sure that people are getting hired as they graduate. And then there's a curriculum design and instruction group, and their job is just to continually go through and improve the tools, improve the materials, improve the curriculum. And then, you know, obviously supporting those folks, we have you know, product, we have engineering, we have all sorts of stuff. Increasingly AI is becoming more and more important. We've rolled out some AI coaching tools that are really, really good that we built. So it's not just, you know, ChatGPT. It understands like where you are in the curriculum. It knows what you know. It knows what you don't know. It knows how you like to learn. It gets better over time. It knows not to just give you answers, but to guide and direct you. And that's becoming our most critical, like, and that's, you know, 24/7 available and infinitely compassionate and infinitely patient the way humans can't be. So we're watching how that develops really closely. But I imagine over time, a lot of students' interaction will be primarily with AI, which is something I would not have predicted a year ago.
But are you looking, for example, like high-level chatbots like on your websites or social media to kind of vet students to, you know, I guess, qualify them to make sure that they're a good fit for the program?
Yeah, we're still building out some of that stuff. The first, like, there are decent chatbots you can pull off the shelf that will, like, you know, understand all of your documentation and, like, can spit out, you know, like, hey, what hours are you available? And they'll tell you what hours something's available. But the bigger, more challenging ones to build, there wasn't something we could pull off the shelf for this. Like, if you, you know, as an example, in our one specific example that I can think of is, we're teaching people to write a for loop, right? And so they're trying to, this, you know, very, very early JavaScript. And, you know, you'll have students writing the for loop, and then they'll ask, you know, ChatGPT, like, hey, how do I write this for loop? And ChatGPT is like, that's not going to be very performant. You're really going to want to use, like, hoisting here. And, like, you have, you're months before you're a month away from touching hoisting as a topic. So ChatGPT doesn't understand that you don't know all that stuff. And then if you ask something specific, like, hey, I'm trying to, you know, it's asking me what the number of apples are, and I'm trying to figure out, you know, how to index through this array, and it's like, I don't get it. And the, you know, ChatGPT would be like, yeah, I don't know. But ours is like, oh, that's because right now we're learning how to, you know, index through an array from the back end, so your numbers are going to be negative versus what you're expecting. You know, little stuff like that that requires ChatGPT to understand the context, let alone like, hey, I'm working on this, give me the answer. And your tutor's like, all right, let's figure this out together. I'm not just going to give you the answer. So that's some of the most important AI we've built. And still sure. Developing, and we'll get better over time and all that stuff.
Sure. So, like, I would ask, just to wrap, you know, what would you say is the one biggest piece of advice that you wish you knew before you started this company?
Oh, man, there's so many. I think the one that extends, I think of us as building both a school and a company. And obviously, they're one and the same, but there's, you learn a lot from dealing with students, and you learn a lot from building a company. The one that is true throughout is, like, if you lower standards on something, you're creating a new standard. And I mean that, you know, of students, if you're a student and I let you do X, that changes what your expectations are, and that changes what you're going to be capable of. And similarly, if you're an employee and, you know, it's totally fine to miss the mark, but if you say that's, like, by design or that's desired to have missed the mark, then you change what the expectations of the organization are. I think a lot of what starting a company really is figuring out how to grow while keeping standards high. And that's really, really difficult to do. And there's always temptation to slow down, to say, yeah, well, that's okay. Or to, you know, just widen the road of acceptability. And pretty soon it's a free for all. And I say that from having experience, having done that, right? We've made all the mistakes that you can make, I think. probably not all of them, but a lot of mistakes.
For sure.
And that's one that I think about a lot.
Makes sense. So if somebody watching this wanted to reach out to you, do you mind sharing your company website or social media handle, just best ways to get in contact with you?
Yeah. I mean, bloomtech.com is us as a company. I'm Austin, A-U-S-T-E-N, at bloomtech.com. And I'm also Austin, A-U-S-T-E-N, on Twitter. And I may be slow to respond to some of those methods, but I really try hard to get back to everybody. So
awesome. Well, Austin, thank you so much for your time, and we're rooting for you.
Yeah, thank you. It's a good chat.
Thanks. Thanks, Austin.
All right. Bye. Bye-bye. Nice meeting you.
We'll see you.